This evening, it's my pleasure to welcome two friends of many years, Helen Thomas, who is the Dean of the White House Press Corps. You might be the Dean of the whole Washington Press Corps.
Don't rub it in.
And who is a columnist for Hearst Newspapers and who worked for many years for United Press International. And Alexis Simmendinger, who works for National Journal, who was at the White House from the George H.W. Bush administration through the George W. Bush administration, and who now works on covering the Senate for National Journal, and so has the perspective of looking at both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue and where information is easier to get.
Exactly.
A lot easier.
A lot easier to get, yes. Exactly.
Senators talk.
I love it.
And what is your experience about presidents and their talking? You've covered the White House, the West Wing of the White House, since the Kennedy administration. And what is your experience?
My experience is they all hate us. The presidents always when they're campaigning, they're promising open administration, everything's going to be great. And as soon as they get into the Oval Office, the Iron Curtain comes down, and information that I believe belongs in the public domain becomes their private preserve. And they're very unhappy with what they call a leak, which is usually information that we should have. Mm-hmm. So I'm a bit cynical about their desire for the open press and so forth.
Why do you think that happens? Because it's true. Nixon, for example, had said ours will be an open administration.
And LBJ said the same thing.
Uh-huh.
Human nature, I think. They really think they've got a secret, and they don't quite trust the public, and they are in charge, so I think they're very unhappy when we really know when they're coming and going or anything else. LBJ would go erupt when he found out that we would know a lot of things about his schedule and so forth.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I remember a person who was to be appointed to to a position was asked about it by a reporter. And the person who I never knew who it was on background, so it was an anonymous quote. And the person said to the reporter, "If you print it, it's wrong."
Well, LBJ would fire whoever leaked the information.
And why, when you think he was a senator, and why, and used to more information coming out why, when they get to the presidency, are they reluctant?
They will put a classified stamp on the color of the walls. Something happens. They become so secretive. All administrations are secretive. The things I think we should know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very self-protective.
Uh-huh.
More and more, I think they can't even justify what they do, but they do it.
Uh-huh. What's your experience, Alexis, in the way that presidents come in, and what do you see as some of the dynamics of why they choose not to provide information?
Well, in the time that I covered the White House, I always thought it had to do with this, because I covered the White House beginning with Bush 41, it was the more modern White House with the permanent campaign, that had become part of politics and part of governing more. And I always thought it had a lot to do with this, the idea that the team that comes in with a president oftentimes is a team, at least in the beginning, that has helped them win election and is dedicated to preserving that particular person, the president. And it's really only later, I think, that they start to realize that there are elements of the presidency that they're interested in maintaining. But I'm so interested in the idea that watching Obama now from afar, not covering him, that there is so much of that in this first year of President Obama, the permanent campaign, the idea that it's all about Obama, the desire to shape and control information and image, and that frustration when they can't seem to pull that off, that's when they start getting concerned about the secrecy and the elements of information leaking out. I know Helen wrote in a book that is terrific. It's now 10 years old, but it's Front Row at the White House, and a lot to learn in this book.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And Helen, you wrote in the book that you think a lot of the leaking that happens in White Houses, and I was wondering what you think about it in the Obama administration, is oftentimes strategic as much as it is
deliberate.
Right, and that you've talked about how the staff start to get at each other, and sometimes they start to use the media. Yeah. And you've had experience with that. Is that happening, do you think, with Obama?
I don't know, but I do think there's a clash often mm-hmm. among the staffers. And when they want to get their point of view out, then that's when you're really able to cover what's going on.
Right.
When they're mad at each other.
Right.
And there's not much loyalty left there. It becomes very self-interest. I think that Obama was totally misunderstood when he ran. I thought he was a liberal. He's mm-hmm. not a liberal. Others thought he was moderate. They don't think he's moderate and so forth. Depends on the point of view. But he left there a lot of mixed interpretations
right.
of himself. And I think that's been a big problem. That's why there's so many people are disappointed because they thought he'd walk on water.
Right. Let me ask you something about the last senator that we watched before Obama coming into the White House was President Kennedy. It's unusual to leave the Senate and launch yourself into the White House, obviously. And you covered President Kennedy. And I noticed in your book that you had something to say that is absolutely so interesting to me because this is something we're watching with Obama. You wrote, and you were thinking of Kennedy and the Bay of Pigs when you wrote this, every new administration comes into the White House with a cocky self-confidence that begs to be deflated, and it doesn't take that long.
No, because
true.
They're on the pedestal.
Right.
And they don't deserve it. For example, I don't think that Obama deserved, at that point, the Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, this was yeah. really a shock.
Shock to him, I would say.
But I think most presidents don't live up to our admiration in
right.
the beginning, anyway. Some develop, some learn on the job.
Right.
There's no such thing as an instant president.
Right.
It is a learning game. But
that hubris, we saw that with President Bush, 43, definitely President Clinton, that first year. And it gets them
tough.
Into such trouble, doesn't it?
Always.
Yeah.
Very
yeah.
tough.
Is there anybody that you can remember, a president who came in the first year and did not have problems with that thinking that they were invincible?
Yes, LBJ, because Kennedy, I mean, Johnson had his eye on the presidency from the age 12,
yes.
actually. And when he was Senate Majority Leader, of course, he had a lot of power and he believed in power. When he became president, I think that everybody gave him so much sympathy.
Yes.
Because of Kennedy's assassination and so forth. So I think that he stepped right into the shoes, mm-hmm. which was really admirable mm-hmm. to become president of the United States mm-hmm. overnight and in great tragedy. Mm-hmm. So I think that people went easier mm-hmm. on him, but he grew in the other way.
Well, you've yeah. written about LBJ that you had never seen a president who was so full of contradictions, that he was so full of ego and yet so insecure, that he could be so mean and tough and yet so soft and caring.
And kind. And with the press, it was love-hate relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to be on the front page every day in good ways and so forth. I think he was constantly insecure, mainly in the job, comparing himself to Kennedy and mm-hmm. so forth. But he was magnificent in getting through the great society. He knew Congress, he knew where the bodies were buried, he knew every man's price.
Mm-hmm.
And so he knew Congress and he was able to get through so many wonderful things, the mm-hmm. Civil Rights Act, voting rights for blacks for the first time in the South, federal aid to education, the environmental laws, was unbelievable what he accomplished. But Vietnam and foreign policy was his demon mode. Mm-hmm. He really didn't quite get it.
And here we're watching this new president who has a very heavy legislative agenda and is having such trouble. Obviously, LBJ had much bigger majorities, Democratic majorities, to work with, and that was a different time, of course, and people have said there you can't do what LBJ did now in the modern Senate or in the modern House. Do you think that's true?
Yes, I think that he doesn't know how to manipulate Congress.
Yeah.
And I have never, as long as I've been in Washington since 1942, I've never seen an opposition work directly against the country, not only the opposition party. These Republicans today on Capitol Hill say no to everything, whether they would want it. I mean, health care. Who can be against the poor and the sick? And they're manifesting the worst kind of personalities and their own greed.
Senator Alexander was on the Hill from Tennessee, a Republican. This afternoon, he's part of the Republican leadership. And President Obama is having the health care summit on Thursday at the White House, at Blair House. And reporters were, including me, we were gathering around him and talking today after the policy luncheons that they have every week, and asking him about, he's going to be attending the summit on Thursday, asking him, what's the format for this? How are you going to be presenting the Republican point of view? Do you have alternatives? And asking him,
just say no.
Yeah, and asking him what he thinks of this arcane budget element of the rules that's called reconciliation, how you can move legislation that is germane to the budget with 51 votes instead of the filibuster-proof 60. So Senator Alexander was saying that it's trickery, and so I said, what's trickery about it? Because it's part of the rules, and it's been used since 1981 many times.
Good for you.
So he said, because it's about bartering. It's about bartering. And I said, and that's never happened in the Senate before, ever. And so then he got very frustrated, and he said, not for something this big, that this is one-sixth of the economy that they're trying to jam through using reconciliation. So I'm only telling you that story because that's an element of the, you say it's white, I'll say it's black, it's daylight, it's dark.
The Republicans do not want this man to succeed in anything. They are so transparent in their desire to destroy the administration.
It's interesting, yeah. It is really interesting.
And they've never seen anything so cruel.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Do you think that the environment is different? And say in Johnson's period, people didn't have to get the same kind of fund for their campaigns as they do now. The party was more involved than it is now, and they were dependent. When he was majority leader, they were dependent on him for a lot of things, for getting help from the party. Maybe getting endorsements from the party, and also helping to raise funds. And now you don't have that, so people are much more independent actors than they were at that
time. What country they're in. Don't they see how many are unemployed in this country? 31 million people without health care? Where are they? On Mars?
Mm-hmm. Do you think that in Johnson's time period that a good portion of the legislation that he was dealing with was legislation that had been thought through to some extent already? So, say, Johnson came in after the Civil Rights Bill had been discussed in the House and the Senate. In the House of Representatives, and like in the House Judiciary Committee, the Democrats and Republicans worked together. Emanuel Seller, who was the chairman, worked together with the ranking minority member, William McCulloch. And the two of them put a bill out that was much stronger than Kennedy's bill. Mm-hmm. And so when Kennedy died, Johnson was able then to put out a stronger piece of legislation. And he was willing to do it. But in part, that there was a building consensus that you needed Medicare, you needed civil rights legislation.
Well, we need these things now. Yeah. But you have none of that. You have none of the sense of country and needs.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also interesting, too, because Helen, you were covering President Clinton when he was arguing for a version of health care reform. So it's not as if health care reform is a new surprise issue for Congress.
Right.
It may
be
for these members of Congress, some of these members of Congress, because the turnover in the House and the Senate is so rapid now.
Right.
We have probably half the Senate has served in the House, so they're much more rabble-rouser and sort of more representing the extremes. And the turnover in the Senate has been so rapid for a variety of reasons. Some of it is their health, some of it is electoral, some of it is retirements to do other things, because you can make money lobbying and that kind of thing. So you have newcomers, too, who have not been simmering with these issues for as long a period of time.
Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's that thing. I think it's an attitude.
Mm-hmm. Well, the American people sure think that in the polls.
Well, that's right, but...
The disconnect.
And Republicans mm-hmm. want the White House back.
Yes.
And they've shown it in every
yes.
way. It's just, I think they're no longer thinking of country.
When you were covering Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, when you wanted information about them and what they were doing, what their plans were, and you just had a question where you needed information.
You could walk down the street with them
and ask them. Tell us what the interactions were like. Interactions with Kennedy. When would you see him? When would you talk with him? And what kinds of questions could you ask and when?
Well, he held fairly frequent press conferences. He also dropped into the press room. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was accessible in that sense, not totally, but the press corps was much smaller,
uh-huh.
and we didn't have cable, and the wire services were much more attuned in that.
Right.
And there wasn't that full-time, although he gave live press conference at television, TV people weren't always there.
Yeah.
So it was much a smaller coterie of people covering him, and often yeah. we would walk down the streets with him, and in the Johnson era, we were right side by side, falling all over each other around the South Lawn. We'd call them the Bataan Death Marches, but we could ask Johnson anything uh-huh. in the book and so forth, so it was much closer and uh-huh. more intimate, I should say.
In a given week, how often would you see President Kennedy? Let's just ballpark. Would you see him
three
or four times a week?
And even during the Cuban Missile Crisis, he came out and he said it's been a very interesting day because someone threw a question at him. And so mm-hmm. Obama is much more, protected.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right, well, I want to read something really quick that President Kennedy said about Helen. She would be a nice girl if she'd ever get rid of that pad and pencil.
That's right. Once I said to him, we were covering the state dinner at the St. Patrick's Day, and I said, it's a great day for the Irish, Mr. President. He said, what are you doing here? And once he came over to the rope line when he was going on a trip abroad, and I was so unhappy I wasn't going, and I had my pad and pencil, and he came over to the rope line. He said, well, aren't you going with me? I said, no, I only go to church with you. He said, you get all the good trips. So it was much closer.
How many women were in the press corps then, the regular full-time White House?
Fran Lewin and myself were there, yes. 24/7. But
and she's with Associated Press.
There were about 10 women.
Ten.
Now we have two anchor women on the Nightly News, and women.
Yeah,
really.
Yes, in a way, yes and no, because I keep track of the briefings and who asks the questions. And if you have a front row seat, and the front mm-hmm. row has the wire services, mm-hmm. the major networks in
uh-huh.
CNN, the second row has Washington Post, New York Times, it has Fox, Wall Street Journal, and there are days when there are no women in either the first or the mm-hmm. second row. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so then some ways it's changed, but in others it hasn't. But in mm-hmm. Kennedy's time, when he would come in to your press room, the press room was in the West Wing itself, mm-hmm. and it was very close to the Oval Office.
That's right.
So when you're looking for the benefit of you all at Towson, when you think about the West Wing and the Marine standing there by the door, on the side that the Marine is, the press room was there, was in that corner of the West mm-hmm. Wing. And so it was very close for him. And when they did television, they did a setup in what is now the lobby. It was a mm-hmm. lobby, and you had an access to information then, because when the president's visitors left, unless they snuck
better.
Them downstairs,
that's right.
They would go by you, and you were able to catch them?
Mm-hmm. And how, and buttonhole them. We didn't have to go outside and freeze either. Got right in the lobby.
Would most people come by and talk to you? Like, say, a Secretary of State went in to see the president, like Dean Rusk went in to see Kennedy.
If it was prepared, you know what I mean, if they're trying to manage the news, yes. But otherwise, we'd catch them on the run anyway.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to talk to the Chief of Staff or some of the top staff, not the press secretary, but the top staff in the days of Kennedy and LBJ, what was the process that you used representing the wires, which were, of course, incredibly important to the president because that communicated around the country mm-hmm. and television at that time, and the major papers still followed what the wires were doing. What was your way of getting access to them? Could you just call them up, or what did you do?
Well, you could call their offices, and they would usually see you. And Alexander Haig, who was a general, just died last weekend. He would have different sessions, even during the Kennedy era, Nixon era. Mm-hmm. When Nixon was on the ropes, we would see him often.
Ah.
Mm-hmm. They were trying to really get a point of view across,
right,
too.
Right.
But news is always managed at the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And hats off to anybody who gets anything else. Because, some reporters become favorites, and they do get better stories.
Yes.
Because the administration thinks they're much more amenable, and I'm not saying just in their pocket, but they got to be liked.
Right, right. In the Obama White House, can you see they're so enamored with new media? Is there the possibility that they're still a favorite? What do you think?
I do. I think that they like that outlet.
They do.
And they have read all of us in the sense that they don't think we're exactly friendly.
Yes. So they think that it's a friendlier medium to go directly out through the internet or blogs or YouTube or whatever.
That's right. That's my feeling.
Okay. But if you look at the interviews the president has done, because say in his first year he did 161 interviews. He did 161 interviews, and not one of them was with the new media.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't do Politico. He didn't mm-hmm. do Huffington Post.
Mm-hmm.
He did 9 with the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he did Financial Times. And he did a lot of major television. He would do ABC, CBS, NBC.
Mm-hmm.
They got a lot of his time. But the staff spends a lot of time mm-hmm. with new media, mm-hmm. that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But what has it given them? You know, what advantage has it been?
I haven't read anything that really acquaints me with Obama's thinking. As far as I'm concerned, it's still far removed.
Do you think part of that is, and part of his difficulty of getting across some of his ideas, has been that he has been on the national scene for a very short period of time, and we don't know him?
No.
Lyndon Johnson we knew when he came into the presidency.
Well, I don't think anybody knows Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And he hasn't been really depicted, I don't think. I'm always surprised mm-hmm. because his rhetoric is a little different than his actions.
Mm-hmm.
I know that governing is different from campaigning, but I see a 180-degree difference.
Would you think that, say, with Kennedy, for example, Kennedy, during his campaign in 1960, Bobby Kennedy visited Martin Luther King in jail. when he was in jail. I can't remember if it was in Birmingham or in Atlanta. But anyway, he had visited him in jail and gave a lot of promise that things could be done. And, for example, I think he said that just one stroke of the pen, that housing, federal housing, could be desegregated. And then when he came in, it just didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And there were some people who said, well, he must not have a pen. And so they started sending pens to the to the White House. But he certainly, there was a difference between what people expected he was going to do on civil rights and what he actually did. It took the bombings in Birmingham, when of the church in Birmingham, when the young girls died, that that's what it took for him to really push for a strong civil rights bill.
Well, I think you saw real growth and development in Kennedy from the Bay of Pigs to the Cuban Missile Crisis. Mm-hmm. I mean, he learned on the job. He learned how to handle a crisis. Mm-hmm. He learned to say no to the generals. Mm-hmm. And all of this is experience. Mm-hmm. And
Helen, you also wrote something that I thought in my watching President Bush 41 and Clinton and Bush 43 was so true. And when I read it in your book, I thought, oh, isn't this amazing that it seems to follow president after president. You wrote, no president ever wanted to admit he had changed policy or changed his mind, even when it was obvious. And in this particular instance, you were using examples of LBJ. But it certainly was true of 41. It certainly was true of Clinton. It certainly was true.
It's a sin to change your mind.
And why is that? Because you just said something really important about the presidency. There's no school you go to. If you're a very inexperienced president like Obama, who had no executive experience at all in anything, you would imagine that they would be quick to say, I can learn on this job. This is a learning process.
Well, I think they are ashamed that they don't know. They're supposed to be all omniscient.
Ah.
And not all omnipresent.
Yes, I
redundant,
see.
But I mean,
yes,
they're supposed to know everything. And if they don't,
right.
My Lord, who?
What do you think?
Why does he think he's president?
It's so interesting because part of what we talk about Obama's personality is that he is professorial. He comes from an academic bent, that he likes to study, that he's cautious, he wants a full range of information before he makes up his mind. So it's interesting that he, too, can be so resistant to saying, you know, what I campaigned on 2 years ago is maybe not applicable to...
Because his advisors will tell him, don't ever admit any weakness.
It's about weakness.
What about the media? Oh. Because, look, you've got, you have PolitiFact, which is keeping, it has its obometer, where it's looking at his promises. Is he keeping all of his promises? And I had talked to Bill Adair during the campaign period.
Do your students know what you're talking about?
The St. Petersburg Times has a website where it is keeping track of all the promises that President Obama made during the campaign. He had a document called Blueprint for Change. And so they've taken his blueprint for change and turned it into specific promises. And so they keep track of that.
And they won a Pulitzer Prize.
And they did.
Because it's such a good operation.
Right.
It's really good.
And before that, when he was developing it, and he, I had talked to him about it, and I was concerned about it because I said presidents do need to grow. Mm-hmm. And that if you have a bad idea during a campaign, and then you get into the presidency and find out it's not a good idea, you should be able to jettison it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that the public understands, that there can be a difference, that there's room for growth. But I think the media is some media. Mm-hmm. I don't want to put media in just one in one basket here, but... I think they do like, there are a lot of reporters and news organizations that want to do that.
That play gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's just, you know, this is what you said, why have you changed?
Why have you changed?
And you could say, well, once I came in, I learned that X, Y, and Z, but no president wants to do that because it looks like a sign of weakness.
That's it. This is the perception, though, of a president is you know, he's all powerful and he can do anything and so forth, and he comes in and And he doesn't do what he said he was going to do. Mm-hmm. And people remember that, especially if they have a particular issue.
Martha, you've written about presidents and those that have been good at stating and those who are good at explaining and how sometimes the two don't meet in the same president. How important is it, Helen, as you've covered presidents, for the American public to embrace if you have a president who's good at explaining? Who were some of the best explainers about their policy or their reasoning or their thinking?
I think that President Carter and Kennedy were so articulate and really brilliant in many ways. I think they were much better. But I don't think that President Bush, the last Bush, didn't attempt to explain and told too many falsehoods that are unexplainable.
Where would you put Reagan? Because Reagan ended up as a relatively still popular president, even after two terms of kind of up and down with the public.
I think that he had a different understanding of the public. He knew they'd forgive him for anything, and he tried to make a joke out of something.
Yes.
But I don't think he was venal in any way, or mean, or I don't think he would ever knowingly approve of torture.
Another thing you wrote that I thought was great. Go ahead.
I was going to say, Reagan's case is a little different because he had campaigned for so long. And, you know, he had done various television appearances where he talked about policy. And in 1964, he was campaigning for Barry Goldwater. And he wrote a speech in 64 that was for Goldwater that he gave over and over again. And it was very much what he did once he got into the White House. Mm-hmm. So in a way, he didn't have the same obligation to explain because everybody knew what he thought.
And he was playing president.
Yeah, that's right.
A great actor.
So, you know, they knew that he was for privatization, budget cuts.
Lower taxes.
For taxes.
No taxes.
That's right.
No taxes.
The Soviet Union was the evil empire.
That's right. Until he found out different. or at least decided it was not quite that bad.
Right.
So there's much less of an accumulated sense of who Obama is, as you were saying.
Helen, you were just saying that that with Reagan, he thought that the public would forgive him anything. And I know in your book you wrote, all the presidents I've covered have demonstrated a sense of humor honed from years in politics. Do you think that that's helpful humor in the White House?
How? I think it's a sine qua non. I think it's indispensable to have humor because it can deflect a lot of bad stuff.
Yes, yes. And who were some of the most skilled at using humor as a weapon?
As a weapon? I think Kennedy had the wit. Johnson was good, but he would give these dimwinders until you got to the point, and then you'd laugh. But it was not just the quit. they were down home.
Right.
My favorite story is when Johnson first became president, he had a stable of speechwriters, as they all do, and he asked for one speech for a farming area, the rural, and the speechwriter brought him the first draft. He looked at it and he said, Voltaire. People I'm going to talk to don't know who Voltaire is. He grabbed a pen, scratched out Voltaire, and scribbled in, as my dear old daddy used to say.
That's called knowing your audience.
That was Johnson humor. Not deliberate.
Do you think that press secretaries also need to have a sense of humor?
Oh, yes. Not only do they need it, I mean, it's absolutely necessary because they're getting they're in the bullseye. It's the second toughest job in the White House, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Okay, remind us, who had this sign? Which press secretary had this sign on his desk? If you can't dazzle them with brilliance, then baffle them with BS. Who was that?
I don't know.
Jody Powell. You wrote in your book that Jody Powell had this on his desk during the Carter administration. If you can't dazzle them with brilliance, then baffle them with BS. Was Jody Powell funny? He died recently.
He was funny, in a southern way.
In a southern way, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Was he a particularly good press secretary? I didn't cover Carter.
I thought he was good in the sense that he was like a son to President Carter.
He knew his boss.
And he obviously had the access that mm-hmm. very few people would have. Mm-hmm. That's right, he knew his boss. Mm-hmm. That's true. Mm-hmm.
And the best press secretaries you've worked with are?
Jerry Terhorst. He lasted 2 weeks. He had been a reporter for the Detroit News, Grand Rapids Press, in Washington for 29 years. He knew everyone in the press corps and so forth.
Right.
And it was President Ford. He had covered President Ford as a Michigan congressman and then vice president. So Ford picked him as press secretary.
Yes.
And we knew immediately that Jerry, we were very good friends. And two reporters, one was Miami News and the other New York Times, came to him on a Friday night and asked Jerry Terhorst. They told him, they said, look, we understand President Ford is sending an emissary to San Clemente, California, to give a pardon to Richard Nixon. Mm-hmm. And Jerry said, well, he didn't know about a big check. And he did check with the lawyer for President Ford. And was told, absolutely not true, and so forth. A couple days later, they announced the pardon for Richard Nixon, and Jerry quit. He didn't have another job. He had a big family to support and everything, but it was a point of integrity. Mm-hmm. He couldn't bear the fact that he had lied. Mm-hmm. And
Inadvertently.
That's right. But he was told from the right. people there mm-hmm. in the White House. Mm-hmm. And he quit the job immediately after the pardon was announced. Mm-hmm. And that was a point of great integrity.
You wrote in your book about press secretaries, a press secretary's job is a hot seat. Great press secretaries wear two hats. The first is that of the voice of the White House, the president, the administration, the federal government, and the United States. And the other hat is more elusive, but just as important. I believe the press secretary is responsible to keep the American people informed with truthful information on a day-to-day basis and to battle from within for a credible flow of information against those who want to suppress, conceal, or deprive the nation of an explanation of the government's goals.
That's right.
And that's what happened to Jerry. Yeah, it's interesting.
Well, except if let's say he had stayed, because he had been compromised, who would have listened to him? The reporters would have not been able to.
That's right. You have to have credibility.
And that happened. But it happened to mm-hmm. Scott McClellan because there were things that he didn't know.
For Bush.
But mm-hmm. it happened to Larry Speaks when he mm-hmm. told Bill Plant that there was no attempt for the military to go into Grenada.
It almost happened to Marlin uh-huh. for President Bush. Mm-hmm.
So it does compromise them and makes it and Ron Ziegler, mm-hmm. In many of their cases they couldn't continue.
I think we expect credibility from one who was former mm-hmm. reporter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think we expect presidents to lie even more than them.
Robert Gibbs knows his boss. What kind of press secretary is he for Obama?
I think he's totally loyal. Mm-hmm. I think he knows how to sidestep anything that's tough. He doesn't really go overboard in any way, get in trouble. I think he's a nice man. Mm-hmm. And I think he is tuned in. But I haven't been able to make up my mind what he is. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What does he not know about the media that you think he's learning about the media?
I think, for one thing, he should not let a reporter go on and on and on when there's a room full of reporters mm-hmm. who have their questions. Mm-hmm. He lets the network TV people ask five questions on different subjects. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's very fair.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah, and he came from the campaign, a campaign world. He's very political.
And he's still on the campaign mode.
Yes.
He's still trying to sell.
Yeah.
Today, when you're looking for information, where do you get it? And from on the White House and on the president? And is it different from Kennedy? I mean, obviously,
oh, yeah, we have
personally.
Internet and everything else. Uh-huh. And as I say, it was much more intimate in covering Kennedy and Johnson's.
But were you able to get as deep information about how a place works, how a White House works, what's going on? Do you have more of that now?
No, I think people talk more.
Uh-huh.
I do.
They talk more now?
Yeah. No.
Then. But you have, in a sense, though, you have more information about how government operates today.
Yes, we have internet. You have much more understanding of what a president is doing and so forth. They put out a press release every 5 seconds.
Mm-hmm. But you then you've got the Freedom of Information Act. I mean, once you have the Freedom of Information Act, there's some different sense about information and what the government should
That's
provide.
True. Do you feel you know Obama?
No, but I don't think I felt that I really knew well any president.
I think others.
I mean, you can know what kinds of actions they've taken.
I think others were more transparent.
Uh-huh.
He doesn't show it. He's pretty stoic.
He certainly has. His White House has given out a lot of information that other White Houses haven't. For example, they give out something which I think is information that is
on the visitors.
The visitors.
That's because they were pressed on that.
Well, but they still could have gotten away with it because the White House isn't. You don't have to respond to FOIA requests. The White House is exempt from that, so it's not something they had to do. But it is revealing. I mean, they've given out information that I think. Certainly does show something about the workings of the government that mm-hmm. they might not want to have out.
One of the things that I'm fascinated about in the modern presidency is how each president is a reflection, trying to contrast or compare to his predecessor.
Mm-hmm.
And Obama is obviously trying to be more transparent as a contrast to the President Bush administration mm-hmm. before him.
Mm-hmm.
To what extent have you seen that migration, you know, each one trying to be the anti-whatever from the previous party, and how that gets them sometimes into trouble?
I'm thinking often that the staff is the most secretive of all at times because they're afraid to tell you anything for fear it'll get them in trouble. But I don't understand why all this information is secret. President Bush got away with murder. I mean, he said there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. He invaded mm-hmm. Iraq, and that isn't held against him. He said there were ties to the Al-Qaeda terrorist network. There weren't at that time because Saddam Hussein was very jealous of his own power. Then he said Iraq, a third world country, was a threat mm-hmm. to U.S., which is a major, superpower.
Mm-hmm. Talk about when...
And he has never explained why we went into Iraq
right.
to this moment, and no one has demanded.
Talk about an era that to a lot of people seems like ancient history, when the press corps used to... work together to maintain a certain confidentiality for a president. In other words, they would keep a secret on behalf of a president. In President Kennedy's case, we find out later that the press corps knew some of the personal things about his personal life mm-hmm. and didn't report those things, or that he worked out negotiations with a major newspaper, for instance, to keep certain information about national security confidential for a period of time. In other words, they work together. It's hard to even imagine that happening now. Talk about your experience.
It would happen now.
Yeah, it
all
did
the
happen.
President.
No. I'm talking about the personal foibles.
Oh,
of a
that
president.
Wouldn't happen anymore. There was a social revolution in the 1960s.
Yes,
no question about it. That before that, reporters would if they knew about a personal liaison of a president or government official, public figure, they would not write about it unless it impinged on his private on its official duties, mm-hmm. and responsibilities. Mm-hmm. That was no man's land, mm-hmm. and you would respect their office. But at once the tabloids started writing about it, the mainstream press would mm-hmm. be accused of covering up if they didn't write about it. Mm-hmm. And so everybody's in the swim. And so I now say, if you want to go into public life, decide at the age of 5 and live accordingly. Because everybody will dig into your past if you stole a bicycle. If you
and everything's out there and it never goes away now, well, right? Every recording of your voice, every photograph, anything is on the internet and it lives forever.
But the recourse of politicians is one. To write a book before you run and put it all in the book. And when they come out, you come up and say, I understand you took drugs. Oh, that's all in the book. That's all explained. That's all.
Well, Obama did that.
Yes.
And other presidents have.
But you know, another area that people didn't, that reporters didn't write about too, was the health of presidents.
That's very true. It was, especially Franklin Roosevelt.
Yeah. And Kennedy to an extent.
That's right.
Yeah.
His Addison's disease, you mean?
Yeah. And I think just gradually we've come to appreciate how important that is, and that it could make a difference as far as decision making is concerned.
That's true.
Yeah. Or even Reagan got a little bit of a glide path there with his Alzheimer's. I mean, there was lots of sort of gentle discussion about his mental acuity. But people were very respectful, I think, of trying to say anything overt until he himself had, clearly he had a problem.
Yeah. Well, let's go to Towson. And do you have some questions there?
Hands up. Grab a microphone.
Good evening. Is there a psychological reason why the president is so careful about leaking information? Or is it to protect the citizens of the states?
Is there a psychological reason why they're protective of information?
Yes.
You mean Obama particularly or all presidents?
Psychological in what sense?
I mean, is there a psychological reason, is there a kind of like a mental reason why it's kind of important for the president to protect them, to protect information from leaking? Or is it just to protect the citizens?
Oh, I doubt that it's to protect the citizens. Right? The president doesn't keep secrets to protect the citizens. It's more his desire to protect themselves.
Themselves.
Yes. Themselves from criticism or from defeat, political defeat in some sense. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Or that your view that presidents think they should be perfect, that the public thinks that they should be perfect.
Right.
And they don't want to provide anything to the contrary. Do you guys have a question?
I'm sorry. I'm Holly Dagris from UCLA, and my question is about what Ms. Thomas was talking about earlier about the Republicans not wanting Obama to succeed. This is kind of controversial, but do you think race has to do with that, or do you think that President Obama, the reason why the Republicans are so harsh on him has to do with race?
His race.
I don't think it's race. I think it's just they want the power back. They had it. I mean, I don't believe they had that kind of bias.
Do
you?
I don't believe that the Republicans in Congress, per se, by and large, think of his race. But I do think that in parts of the country, in some of these yes, definitely. In some parts of the country, in some of these tough races that we're watching for the midterms, I think that it's a very hard thing to establish But when you listen to the voters talk about their concerns about the Democrats and what's happening in Washington, in some ways you can hear an undertow of concern about President Obama or a lack of acceptance of President Obama that I think in some parts of the country is race-based. Mm-hmm. But I would say it's a minority view. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Allison?
Helen, you spoke earlier about the Republican Party losing some sense of country, essentially. But isn't it true that demographically they make up a significant portion of the session, of the Congress, and have at least some support from the electorate? What role do you think that the media in recent years has played in shaping those perceptions and that support that they received from the electorate? And what lessons do you think journalists should draw?
It's always hard to determine what is motivating people. I think in terms of you turn on Fox, you find all hatred of Obama and everybody else in the Democratic Party. I have never seen such polarization is what I'm saying. It seems to me that people are walking blindly behind certain leaders and they really don't know why they are. I don't say you should always support the president. Far from it. I think when he's wrong, he's wrong. But I never have seen such a solid block against everything the president does. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that has grown, that intense partisanship? Has it been gradually growing, or is it something that you see that is has grown at a different level in the Obama administration?
I think with the Obama administration, I've been here since 1942. I have never seen, or you can't at least have some of the opposition party voting with the majority.
Mm-hmm. When there was a lot of opposition to Franklin Roosevelt, but mm-hmm. you know, he had strong critics.
He did.
But what was the difference of his strong critics and Obama's? Because he certainly...
I think that the people, Roosevelt had the people with him. And the people were unemployed. They were on the streets. They were freezing. They were hungry mm-hmm. and so forth. And I think he had the country with him in that sense. And even though all the Republican leaders were against him, I think there were some around, mm-hmm. especially at the start of World War II. When Senator Vandenberg of Michigan, who had been an isolationist, I mean, a lot of them then rallied for the cause. And I'd admit that war is a little different. But he did have some support because mm-hmm. he had to. I mean, all these states were really down on their uppers in every sense of the word. And also, Roosevelt was a very strong leader. And he was able to ridicule the people who were against helping the poor and the sick.
Mm-hmm. Did you go to any of Roosevelt's press conferences? He was very different, the press conference structure then and today. He had two of them a week. Mm-hmm. And today they're a rare commodity.
That's right.
Did you go to any?
I didn't know my late husband was a regular for the Associated Press, covered the White House. Uh-huh. And he went to all the news conferences.
Did he talk about them?
Oh, yes. I mean, he said in the sense that, of course, they were all in love with Roosevelt because they thought he was the man on the white horse, and he certainly was doing all the things. But he wrote straight copy also. There was so much. Every publisher in the country was against Roosevelt. They were all Republicans. Mm-hmm. So the press, the reporters were not, but the publishers were.
Mm-hmm. There was an interchange that Hugh Seide had with of Time magazine, who was covering the presidency in the Kennedy administration, and the person who owned the Time magazine was a Republican, and. And Seide had written an article where he was talking about a particular event that Kennedy, where he had spoken and what the size of the crowd was. And so Kennedy was talking to Saidi and saying, you know, you put down many, many thousand less than were there. Why did you do that? And he said, I sent it in. You know, it wasn't my fault. I sent it in. And they, you know, they changed
it. Aired it out.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And they cut the crowd by, you know, a third.
Let me just say, editors are always a menace.
Nobody likes an editor.
Right. Nobody likes their editors.
Yeah. And pride of authorship. Uh-huh.
Do you have a question? Okay. Towson?
Before you were talking about presidents learning on the job, what can you say about President Obama's performance of learning on the job now in his second year?
I think he's learning, finally getting some spine on the things that he supposedly believes in. I think he caved too much, and that's why he lost a lot of his constituency. He didn't have enough courage to really have strong convictions or stick up to his own convictions.
And let me just add, in the past few days, I've interviewed a whole lot of governors who were here in Washington, but I was interviewing a Democratic governor, and today I was interviewing an aide to a Republican senator in the leadership of the Senate, and I was asking them both the same question that you just asked, which I want to compliment you on because I think it's a great question. What have you seen that shows you that Obama is learning on the job? The Democratic senator that I was interviewing was Senator Granholm of Michigan, and you know Michigan has the highest unemployment in the country, really tough place to live. And she is originally supported Hillary Clinton for president, but she became a very stalwart Obama supporter. And she said she felt exactly, she said the same thing that Helen just said, that she thought that he had learned to not just give in to Congress, go ahead and write the legislation, and you figure out how we're going to do this, and I'll just trail after you. She thought that he's learning how to negotiate and to dictate, to try to do both things at the same time. And interestingly, the Republican aide I was interviewing said the exact same thing and said, you know, I think he's learning that he can't just let Congress figure out how things, this is his agenda. He has to figure out how to drive it. He has to drive the car.
It's only this week that he's actually presented his health care proposal.
Right. So it's interesting that there seemed to be bipartisan agreement on something.
Yeah.
And he was trying to make up for what Hillary Clinton didn't do, which was to touch base with Congress, but he went over for it.
Well, he felt that he was from Congress, right? But maybe he didn't recognize how the Senate didn't feel that he was necessarily from them, since he was such a newcomer. It was interesting.
Can you think of some other things that he's learned in his... for both of you, that he's learned in his first year?
I wrote the other day that Obama has a foreign policy. It's called war. I have not seen real good stuff in foreign policy to keep us out of killing and dying all halfway around the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it seems to me he's learned a little bit about the limitations of reaching out and trying to repair America's image abroad, that has been useful and beneficial, but it's not going to get you world peace. It's not necessarily going to get you agreements. It's not going to get you trade agreements. You know, no matter how much they're welcoming America back into this negotiating mode, it's not going to solve everything.
He's buying into a new enemy every other day.
Mm-hmm.
He really tried to reach out to Iran, I grant you, and didn't work. But you don't go all the way to the other end and suddenly they're enemies and so forth. Hillary Clinton was complaining that the Iranians were going into a military dictatorship. Mm-hmm. Well, we've thrown a bone to all the revolutionaries because they feel very threatened. Mm-hmm. Every day we're supposed to be bombing them and being urged to do so and break all kinds of relations, have toughest sanctions. And what would any leader of any country do when these things were happening on the outside mm-hmm. and they wanted to retain their leadership? Right. You'd get tougher, you'd become more militaristic, mm-hmm. and you wouldn't compromise.
The other two things that I would mention that I think he's thinking about more is that you can sequence your agenda, and the sequence makes a difference to your success or failure. That maybe in his case, it's been talked about that he tried to drive too many big things through Washington at the same time. And the other thing I was thinking about is that he may have learned the limitations of his communications abilities, yes. that he was adored almost for his compelling campaign rhetoric and his ability to persuade and to move people, and that is obviously a political art form, and he has it. He's a wonderful communicator on the written page. He considers himself a great writer, and he does write very well. But I do think he's learned as president that there's a whole different category of communication, and I think he's learned something about that, the limitations.
He is left with two major wars. Mm-hmm. And a depression. I call it a depression, mm-hmm. a recession.
Michigan would call it a depression. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, that's my home state.
Yes.
But there's no question that's a load. And then they expect you to have many new proposals, innovations, yes. and solving right. all these problems.
Right. Well, he didn't want to be small. You know, Obama didn't want this sort of micro-presidency. He wasn't really into incrementalism. And I think he's beginning to think, hey, that looks pretty good right now. You know, you can build. I mean, LBJ did great things, big things, but he also did things that added up together.
That's right. And he knew Congress.
He understood Congress.
Experience. And he twisted arms out of their sockets
yes.
to get a vote.
Yes. But he had an enormous majority, too.
He had a huge majority. And a different age.
1964 mm-hmm. was a yes. very different kind of election.
Right.
That he really brought in a lot with him. But one of the things about Obama's communications that he's so good about is that he's good in explaining his personal story. Mm-hmm. And telling you about, during the campaign, about what he felt, what he thought he would do. But when you're governing, you're right, Alexis, it's an entirely mm-hmm. different kind of communication mm-hmm. because you're communicating not just to those people that you want to get to vote for you, but you're also communicating to members of Congress and to the bureaucracy as well in terms of implementation of legislation and about things that all of these people know a great deal about, and sometimes they know more than you do. Mm-hmm. But he did say that explanation was very important to him, mm-hmm. that he talked about that in early in his presidency.
Well, I don't think he's explained properly the why we're in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. But his position on Afghanistan is one thing that's been pretty similar.
Yeah, that's right. It was true to his campaign.
Yeah.
Good question.
Another question from Calson.
What do you think the cause of an increase in reporters' interest in the coverage of the national government?
What's the cause?
That reporters are more interested in covering the national government, she was saying, now.
There's very few newspapers. They're all dying. And the local news is not as interesting as national news because we're all tuned in. With the television, internet, and so forth. I think that we're not, even though they say politics is all local, I really think that everyone's interested in what's happening in the national government because they're all affected. Everything that's been happening in our country affects every individual.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And even in local newspapers and local news, there's a major national component. You can't walk away from it. I remember my mother telling me that one person she had talked to, I grew up in Alexandria, Virginia, which is across the way, and that one person she knew said, this was during World War II, that she liked reading the Alexandria Gazette because she never had to read about the war.
Right across the Potomac.
And that's not true in any newspaper today, even the Alexandria Gazette.
Right.
Because government now does so much more.
That's right.
The national government does.
Right.
I mean, if you look from the 1960s, you know, you have consumer protection, you have civil
environmental
rights,
protection,
right, Americans with Disabilities Act, just so many different kinds of things, all the environmental legislation.
Right.
That what it is that the national government is doing is much greater.
And Helen and Martha have both written extensively about how the White House has grown in staff and size as a response to that idea that Americans expect the president to be, you know, everything, right? Doing everything.
That's right. And they fight against it, and yet they can't. I mean, big government, and yet you want to take away their Social Security, Medicare.
Right.
Public schools, libraries, roads, highways, bridges.
Right. But progressively, modern presidents are bringing the government into the West Wing. They're they're trying to control more of the apparatus of government. And
I think that's
One more question, Towson, and then we'll wrap it up.
How big of a role do you think that the media played in the election of Barack Obama?
Huge. Helen?
They fell in love.
Yeah. And the Obama administration, the Obama campaign team was so gifted at figuring out ways to find the audiences wherever they were. Down to the micro level, you know, where you were on your block as opposed to where you were in your state, and reach them. It was a very sophisticated enterprise, as we've all written, thanks to a lot of technological innovation. But there's no question that reaching a younger audience, reaching a technologically savvy audience, being able to slice and dice
people
ready for change, and they exploited that. Yeah.
So in a way, the media interest in Obama was a reflection of the public interest. There was public out there that wanted to read it. Just like now, if you look, say, in Obama's first year, he was able to, his staff were able to persuade the major networks to give an hour for press conferences four times in his first year, and Clinton and Bush only had one such press conference. And why is that? Part of it is because they know people are going to watch. They it's costly for news organizations because they're giving up the advertising that they would have normally gotten. But on the other hand, he's news. You know, 49 million people watch one of his press conferences. So
Not particularly glamorous or credible phenomenon is that, as Helen said, the dying print media found out that Obama was like a commodity that sold paper, sold books, sold posters, sold T-shirts, and everybody was after a piece of that. The media had a business interest in just this phenomenon that Obama became. The public's interest became exalted in the media. I mean, can you imagine? You just can't imagine selling T-shirts and books, George W. Bush. I mean, it just wasn't the same. The public was so hungry for the youth and the energy and the newness. Mm-hmm. If there's a bias in the media, the bias is towards something new. And Obama was definitely something new.
Eloquent.
And, you know, his youth, his energy, the fact that he made history as an African American, the public and the media conspired together to say we're ready for something new.
And wouldn't you say that going back to the first president who you were assigned to cover in the West Wing, John Kennedy, isn't that the same thing? That
definitely.
After
the,
with
the
Eisenhower?
New frontier, definitely an excitement.
The young family.
Helen wrote that the word was vigor, with the Boston accent. Vigor. He had vigor.
And they also had great ideas.
Yes, great ideals. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sending a man to the moon.
One story I want you to tell, because this will show something funny, I think, about our technology. As a wire reporter, wire reporters had to be near phones. I mean, it seems impossible to imagine now because we walk around with the phones practically attached to our ears at all times. But when you were covering John Kennedy, when he lived in a row house in Georgetown, there was a woman across the street who was a big Kennedy fan, and she let the wires put what in her yard?
Phones.
Phones. And talk about how important that was, because you had to stand on the sidewalk or in the street covering him, right?
And when Kennedy was making a lot of his cabinet announcements on his front porch.
During the transition.
During the transition period, before he went into the White House. So it was bulletin news. Yes, and you run across the street and go to the phone. This lady was wonderful to us.
But you were out of the money if you could not find a phone. So the wires put a phone in this lady's yard in Georgetown so that you could cover this young, vigorous president, right?
And there was no such thing as a cell phone.
No cell phones.
No, everyone had his wires.
What was it like? You described it as being in her yard. Was it like a phone booth?
No.
What was it?
Attached to the fence.
Attached to the fence? Yeah. So you would go across the street to her fence?
That's right.
And then was there a phone for each wire?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
But that happened when you were traveling. I traveled on the Ford campaign in 76 to New York and New Jersey. And they
it was
set,
the same?
Yeah. But they set up, I mean, it's part of the arrangements that the White House provided. Is they set up phones at the place where he was
speaking. I just love the story of the lady.
Yeah.
Yes.
The lady across the street from him saying, oh, yeah, go ahead, use my yard.
That's right.
And when Reagan was shot, there was a person who worked for one of the networks who immediately, when the shots rang out, he looked across the street, saw that there was a shop. It was, I think it sold, soft drinks and that kind of thing. And he went, laid out cash and said, I want this phone open. And so he held that phone and was able to do that.
He rented the phone.
He rented the phone. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he just carried a roll.
Well, communications is everything. And if you don't have a phone, you're out of luck.
Right. And it wasn't that long ago. I mean, I'm just saying that this is in my lifetime.
We've run 2-3 blocks to get to a phone.
Yeah.
Beg for a phone.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well,
thank you both very much.
Thank you, Helen.
Thank you,
Talison. Great question.